In this and the next lecture, I'd like to give you a quick introduction into quantum field theory, just so that you know what's happening, so that you have an overall framework, so that you can then fill in all the math and the physics that we do later, that you have a framework to fill that in. Because otherwise, you need a lot of patience, right, to see where this is all going. Okay, so this and the next lecture are going to be a rough, quick introduction into quantum field theory. Let us start with an intuition. Quantum fields are obviously the quantization of fields. And a visualization of fields can be had by thinking of a pond, a lake, and you have on this lake some waves going, like in this picture. And obviously, this lake is quite agitated here, but you could imagine also a setup where you would have an indoor pool and there are absolutely no waves. If nobody is in there, no waves. And then you could have a waveform generator that just does something like this, and then you have plane waves going over that pool. This, of course, is a linear combination of all of that going on. Now, how can we how would we measure the wave action here? Well, one way to measure it would be to take the cork from a bottle of wine, throw it into the water, and then you'll see how that cork goes up and down according to the waves where the cork is at that point. Now, in this case, the cork will go up in an irregular pattern, but if we had switched on the waveform generator that just continuously produces some continuous wave, then we have a wave crossing over that pond, and our cork, no matter where it sits, if there's this periodic wave action going, the cork will go up and down in a sinusoidal way, cosine or sine. And what that tells us is that we should expect harmonic oscillators to play a role in the description of fields because of this harmonic motion up and down. And since the cork could be sitting anywhere, and wherever it is, it does this harmonic motion, we should expect that the description of fields involves a harmonic oscillator at every point. Right? So every point in space has its own harmonic oscillator, just like in this lake. Wherever you put the cork, you find there is a harmonic oscillator going on. However, these harmonic oscillators are not independent of each other. Remember that if you have two springs, you have two harmonic oscillators. But you can also couple these harmonic oscillators to each other. For example, there could be a spring between them. Then you have coupled harmonic oscillators, which means if you excite one, you automatically also excite the other. Whatever one does, the other one knows about. In other words, what one harmonic oscillator does is correlated with what the other one does. This is the situation that we have on a lake as well. Yes, we have a harmonic oscillator at every point, but these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. For example, we can throw multiple corks into this lake. Let's say four of them. So here's one, there's one, there's one, here's one, for example. And then each one of them bobs up and down, with as a consequence of this complicated wave pattern. And this might be the typical recording of one cork, its up and down motion, not for the simple waveform generator that's just one cosine, but instead if it's actually an agitated lake with waves crisscrossing and going all the way, I mean all in all directions. In this case, one cork might have this up and down motion, another cork that one, and you have like four corks at four different locations, and they have this up-down motion. And then if you look at it closely, you will find, they're correlated. You can tell a little bit about what one cork does because you've seen what the other one did. And the reason is that, let's say here's a cork, a wave comes along, it makes it bob up and down, but that same wave will also hit the other corks. But the waves are coming from all directions, right? So overall, we can, for example, describe what's going on in this wave field by recording the oscillations at four detection stations and then see how they're correlated. In fact, that's how it works for quantum fields. One of the most important tools for describing quantum fields is to consider the local amplitude at a point that's called phi of x, and consider that at multiple points, and then calculate how these ups and downs are correlated to each other. So we will be concerned in this course later on with the correlators and the correlations between the ups and downs of fields in multiple points. This could be the electric field, magnetic field, could be a scalar field, and so on. But for now, let's think of the of just water waves as an analogon. So what I wanted to say with these two slides is that what we have in a field, such as this wave field, is a system of harmonic oscillators that are, in fact, coupled to each other. You can test that if, for example, there are no waves, and then you throw a stone in one point, at one point into the water, then, of course, there will be large waves there. But clearly, this harmonic oscillator at that location where the stone hit, this harmonic oscillator is coupled to the neighboring ones, as you can tell, because the neighboring oscillators will get excited too. So all these harmonic oscillators are excited. And we can anticipate also how that might look in the math of it. If you have a harmonic oscillator at a location x, then what does the harmonic oscillator equation look like? Well, it means that the amplitude at x to the second time derivative is proportional to minus the amplitude. Right? It's the harmonic oscillator. Second time derivative is proportional to the amplitude. Second time derivative of the amplitude is proportional to the amplitude. That's why you get sine and cosines as solutions, right? So you, at every point, you have that the second time derivative is proportional to the field itself. So phi double dot is proportional to phi. However, these harmonic oscillators are also coupled to the neighboring harmonic oscillators. And that means that you have one harmonic oscillator of that form at every point, but they're related to each other. And that is accomplished through spatial derivatives, as we will later see. And that makes the whole thing a partial differential equation that depends on both space and time, such as the Klein-Gordon equation, such as the Maxwell equations, and so on. If you drop the space derivatives, you just get a harmonic oscillator at every point. But the space derivatives are important because they couple the harmonic oscillators. They make waves spread. And those derivatives, those space derivatives, are also crucial to understand the phenomenon of entanglement in fields, as we will see later. OK, so what we have is a system of coupled harmonic oscillators in the case of water waves, but also in general for electromagnetism and, thank you. Thanks, Avnish. So system of coupled harmonic oscillators. So the plan now is to do the following. We will, I will quickly remind you of harmonic oscillators, both classical and quantum, just the points that matter for quantum fields. And then the second point is we will look at relativistic fields, so not just the Schrödinger equation, but relativistic, as I indicated a bit in the previous lecture, you know, Klein-Gordon and Dirac. And then third, we will look at second quantization and what it does concretely. And then the fourth point we won't get to today, but let me just indicate of what it's going to be. We're looking at these harmonic oscillators of fields. These three points are just the first two points are just about individual harmonic oscillators. And then we do the second quantization and do it for fields and their vacuum fluctuations. OK, so these are the next four points that we will address. Let's start with the first one, reviewing harmonic oscillators, classical and quantum, just the stuff that matters for quantum field theory. Classical harmonic oscillator has the energy given by p squared over 2 plus omega squared half q squared. I'm setting the mass equal to 1 now. We can always choose the units such that the mass would be 1. OK, so the energy function is also called the Hamiltonian. And for harmonic oscillators, it's always of this form, p squared over 2 plus omega squared q squared over 2. Kinetic energy plus potential energy, and the potential energy is a parabola. The equations of motion of a harmonic oscillator are that the second derivative of the amplitude, so the first derivative of the momentum, is equal to minus omega squared q. So q double dot is equal to minus omega squared q, which clearly has as its solutions sine of omega t and cosine of omega t and all the linear combinations of them. That's one equation of motion. The other equation of motion is that q dot is p. In principle, I mean, it is often thought that this is a definition, but it's not really. It's actually an equation of motion. So we have these two equations of motion here, and I'm writing them down as two equations of motion, not as one equation of motion and a definition, because we will need to do the analogon for quantum fields. We will need to find the analogon of these two equations of motion. And the equation of motion for quantum fields is not going to look anywhere close to this. We will have to derive what it actually is for fields. It's not really just that the canonically conjugate momentum field to a field is not just its time derivative. Not in general relativity. In Minkowski space it is, but in general it's more complicated. And so we will have to properly derive those two equations of motion. Now, this is the classical harmonic oscillator, and we can ask for the classical harmonic oscillator, what is its lowest energy state? What's the solution to this harmonic oscillator problem with the lowest energy? This is a question that's very important later on for quantum fields, because the lowest energy state is the vacuum state, where there are no particles present. Or is it? You see, in Minkowski space, that's true. The lowest energy state is the state without particles. But as we will later see, in an expanding spacetime, the no particle state is not the lowest energy state. It's a weird thing. There's a subtle thing going on there. They're not the same concepts, actually. They're very close, but not the same. But either way, it's going to be very important to know what the lowest energy state is. Now, in the case of a single harmonic oscillator that is classical, it's clear what the lowest energy state is. It's the state where the amplitude of the oscillator is zero, so q of t is zero for all times, and the momentum of the harmonic oscillator is also zero, so p of t is zero for all times, and then clearly the Hamiltonian, the energy, is also zero at all times because the p is zero and the q is zero. We can visualize this by drawing the parabola of the potential and indicating that the system is always at the origin with zero speed by putting a dot here saying that's where the system is forever. This is a state where nothing moves and we are certain about it. Classical harmonic oscillator. And in the case of a field, it would be, well, it's an indoor pool, there's no waves, there's nobody in the water, no waves whatsoever. Lowest energy state. Okay, so now the quantum harmonic oscillators, and of course you know those as well already. So we consider the quantum theory that corresponds to the harmonic oscillator. And people say, and I'm also writing it here, that we are quantizing the harmonic oscillator. Of course, logically, that's nonsense, right? Because it's not like we start with a classical harmonic oscillator and then we find the quantum theory for it. Historically, that's how it went, but logically, it's not the case. Everything in nature is quantum, and the classical harmonic oscillator is a special case that's derived in a certain approximation. So the only way you can really logically go is from a quantum harmonic oscillator to a classical harmonic oscillator by making suitable approximation. Okay, so how does a quantum harmonic oscillator look? As always, in a quantum theory, when you compare it with a classical theory, as always, the energy functional, the expression for the energy is the same. So the Hamiltonian is the same in the classical as in the quantum case. Also, the equations of motion are the same. If we work in the Heisenberg picture where the observables are time dependent. So the Hamiltonian and the equations of motion are unchanged. They are the same classically as quantumly. But the canonically conjugate pairs of variables, in our case here, Q and P, can no longer commute. In the quantum theory, they don't commute. So overall, then, the harmonic oscillator in the quantum framework looks like this. The Hamiltonian is unchanged, P squared half plus omega squared half Q squared. And I put now hats on the observables to indicate that this is the quantum theory. The equations of motion are simply carried forward from what we had up here. Same equations of motion, just that we now have these equations of motion for the Heisenberg picture observables. Both of them is just the same. But now we have that the position and the momentum, and the important thing is not that they are position and momentum. The important thing is that they are canonically conjugate to each other. And we will later see exactly how the canonically conjugate is calculated. That has to do with the so-called Legendre transform. So what we have here is that the Q and the P are no longer commuting with each other. Instead, the commutator is I H bar times the identity. Because of that, as we already discussed in the previous lecture, these guys cannot be represented as numbers. Instead, they are now operator-valued functions of time. So for every point in time, we get a different operator here. For every time t, we get a different operator p hat. An operator is just another word for a matrix that may be infinite dimensional. Again, let's ask, what's the lowest energy solution to this problem here? Having again in mind that this is not just about an individual harmonic oscillator. Later, we will ask the same question for a bunch of harmonic oscillators, in fact, for a continuum of harmonic oscillators, one for every point in space. And then we ask again, what is the lowest energy state for this bunch of harmonic oscillators? And of course, that will then be the vacuum state, at least as long as we don't have effects of general relativity that mess with that. So for now, we are just looking at one quantum harmonic oscillator. And we ask, what is the lowest energy solution now? Well, the lowest energy state of the harmonic oscillator might be called psi naught. And psi naught is an eigenstate to the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator. And the eigenvalue we may call E naught. And you know, of course, that E naught is 1 half h bar omega, which curiously is no longer zero. For the classical harmonic oscillator, the lowest energy that it could be in is zero. But for the quantum harmonic oscillator, the lowest energy that the system could have is 1 half h bar omega. Why is it? Why is it that the lowest energy is elevated? Again, that's going to be important for quantum fields. Because if every point in the quantum field has a harmonic oscillator, and every harmonic oscillator has an elevated energy above zero, well, then we have that infinitely many times. Because every harmonic oscillator contributes a half h bar omega. And there are uncountably many of them. And the universe might be infinitely large, which means that the vacuum energy we would expect to be infinite right away. And in fact, that's what we get with quantum field theory. Now, as we will see, in ordinary quantum mechanics, it doesn't matter whether there's an offset or not. And that's because if you add a constant to the Hamiltonian, that constant is harmless because it's a constant times the identity. It's harmless because it drops out in all commutators. And the Hamiltonian only acts by commutator. But in gravity, this is a concern. And that's because energy is mass. Energy gravitates. And if there's extra energy, it ought to gravitate. So in gravitational physics, we can't just throw that away. So right at the beginning of this course, we ran here into the main problem of combining general relativity with quantum theory, which is that fields consist of infinitely many harmonic oscillators, even in just a small volume. You have infinitely many of them. And if you were to integrate up the ground state energy, it would be infinite. And all of that energy would gravitate and would make space collapse because of all that mass in there. Or it might make it explode. Now you might think, okay, but what if we put a cutoff and we say, oh, there cannot be all that many harmonic oscillators there. But even if you assume that space is not really a continuum, then you can say, well, maybe space is discrete. How do we know that it is continuous? Well, in accelerator experiments, such as at CERN, we probe small distances with very high energy radiation. The high energy is important because it means small wavelengths. And so we can probe small distances. And the distance that is being probed at accelerators today is about 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 21 meters. Down to that resolution, we know that space-time is continuous. But below that, it might be discrete. In which case, we have a finite number of harmonic oscillators in every volume, if it's discrete, because there's only so many harmonic oscillators in so many discrete points then. And we can calculate how much vacuum energy that would be. And it's still way too much. Way, way, way too much. The vacuum energy that you would get if space was discrete at the scale of 10 to the minus, let's say, 25 meters or so, that vacuum energy, just summed up naively, is way more. It would have to gravitate so much that the universe would go crazy. It wouldn't behave at all like it does behave. One of the major problems in physics, to reconcile that fact. But then we might ask, okay, but maybe this is not to be taken seriously, that the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is 1/2 h bar omega. Maybe that's just some mathematical curiosity. And that's why in quantum field theory it doesn't matter. Not so easy. Let me explain why. So the lowest energy state of a quantum harmonic oscillator, the state psi naught, has a wave function that's a Gaussian. Namely, consider the eigenbasis of the position operator. So it's the q ket vectors of the position operator q hat. So q hat acting on a position eigenvector is the position times q. I'm writing it down for one dimension, but it's the same thing for three dimensions, just with more indices. And then these guys are orthogonal to each other. And then remember that the position wave function of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator is the overlap of the ground state with the position eigenvectors. And that's the explicit form of it. It's a Gaussian, where the spikiness of the Gaussian, the width of it, is determined by omega. So that's the probability distribution for the amplitude of the harmonic oscillator in its ground state. So if you measure the position or the amplitude of the quantum harmonic oscillator, then you find that it's likely to be at small q values, but it could also be at larger q values. It's just less likely. The most likely position to find the harmonic oscillator in is, of course, zero, because that's where the Gaussian is largest. But of course, that's impossible that you find it at zero itself, because that's just a point in a continuum. What you really need to do is calculate the integral over the square of the wave function over some interval, and then you get the actual probability, not just the probability density, for finding the position somewhere in that interval. And of course, the square integral over the whole thing is 1, because the amplitude has to be something. So if this is the analog, the quantum analog of the classical harmonic oscillator as being in its resting position, what is this? What's the intuition behind this? Well, let's see. In the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, what is the position expectation value? Well, in order to calculate the position expectation value, q bar, we calculate this matrix element here. We have the position operator, And we have the ground state to the left and the right, so we calculate the position expectation. Which means in the position representation that we have to integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity, psi star psi times q. Since this is a Gaussian, that's a Gaussian, both of them even function, and q is an odd function, the whole thing is zero. So the position expectation value is zero. We are equally likely to find it to the left and to the right. However, there are quantum fluctuations around zero. We can calculate what the standard deviation is if we were to repeatedly do this experiment, prepare a harmonic oscillator in its ground state, and then every time we measure the position, we get all sorts of position values, and the standard deviation is given by this. It's the expectation value of q hat minus q bar, which is zero in this case, squared, and then the square root of that. The usual formula for the standard deviation. And that comes out to be square root of h bar over 2m. So I plotted here again what the wave function of the ground state is, the Gaussian, but I also plotted the potential function, the parabola of the harmonic oscillator potential. And what we see there is that if the particle was sitting exactly at zero, then its potential would be zero. But if you find it anywhere else, then it's at the location where the potential is actually elevated. And so you can then ask, well, what is the average value of the potential that the particle has, given that it could be anywhere here? I mean, it becomes less likely out here, but the further out it is, the higher the potential is, and so on, right? Well, if you calculate the energy expectation value, you find it's h bar omega half, right? So the reason why the harmonic oscillators, the quantum harmonic oscillators ground state is elevated in energy above zero is exactly because it is fluctuating around the origin, and there's a potential. And therefore, it's not just a mathematical artifact. It's very physical that the harmonic oscillator's ground state energy is elevated, h bar omega. And therefore, we should expect the same thing to happen for quantum fields. If they are made out of harmonic oscillators, then they too have that exact phenomenon. The quantum field's amplitude is going to oscillate, it's going to fluctuate positively and negatively, either way. It's going to be at the location where the potential is elevated, and so the expectation value should be elevated, should be h bar omega half. So it's not easy. In fact, it's impossibly hard so far to reconcile the prediction that quantum fields should have infinite vacuum energy with the fact that energy gravitates, and an infinite amount of energy should be infinitely gravitating. Nobody has been able to reconcile that. Now, it turns out that there used to be a glimmer of hope that we have an explanation for this, which is that when you calculate the analogon of this for fermionic harmonic oscillators, and for quantum fields there is such a thing as a fermionic harmonic oscillator, you find that it's just the opposite contribution. It's just a negative amount of energy, same amount. And if in nature, for every bosonic field, there is also a fermionic field with the same number of degrees of freedom, then the vacuum energy from one should cancel the vacuum energy of the other. In the 70s, it was proposed that there is a symmetry in nature called supersymmetry, which means that for every boson field, there's a fermion species. And if in nature that was an exact symmetry, then that would not be a problem. The vacuum energy would be zero because it's just canceled. The bosonic and the fermionic contributions just cancel. In fact, however, we do not have supersymmetry. Supersymmetry might be a broken symmetry in the sense that at high energy it exists, at low energy it doesn't. It's broken. But the evidence is now pretty firm that even at high energies we don't have supersymmetry. So we do need some other explanation. In fact, it gets harder. It's even more difficult than what I was explaining here, because the vacuum energy experimentally is not really zero. It has a finite value, as we will see later in the course. It has a finite value. So supersymmetry would be overdoing it if it was there. But that finite value that we find experimentally is way lower than what the vacuum energy would be, by dozens of orders of magnitude lower. So that's a double challenge here. On one hand, we need to explain why this enormous amount of vacuum energy that is predicted from just this little observation is somehow either not there or not gravitating. On the other hand, we also have to explain why there is a vacuum energy, but just very, very, very little. Just enough to make our universe accelerate. Noticeably accelerate. Okay, so we talked about harmonic oscillators. Yeah?
So typically, like in a QED course and whatnot, they would say, like, oh, you have a finite density of modes in a particular volume. And maybe that for those purpose of calculations, that will be satisfactory. So what is the assumption that we're moving forward with?
Okay, so if you work on Minkowski space, so you're just doing particle physics as it is used at CERN, then the vacuum energy never matters. Because the vacuum energy is just an addition to the Hamiltonian, which is a number times the identity. But the equation of motion in the Heisenberg picture is always that if f hat is an observable, then f hat dot, well, I h bar f hat dot, is equal to the commutator of f hat with the Hamiltonian, right? But if you add to this Hamiltonian some huge vacuum energy times the identity operator, well, that cancels out because f hat commutes with the identity. So in non-gravitational physics, we never care about that. It pops up. These energies pop up because the harmonic oscillators of the field have that energy, but they can be what is called normal ordered away. But in gravitational physics, we can't get so easily rid of it. As we will see, it's not just that. There's more going on because every energy gravitates, including that.
So moving forward, it's still looming, right? We haven't...
No, we have. Nobody has really solved it. Yeah. It's looming, that's right. But it's also great for you guys because somebody has to figure it out eventually, right? Okay, so we talked about harmonic oscillators. Now, relativistic quantum fields. So, relativistic quantum fields. Let us start with the Schrödinger equation, which is, of course, non-relativistic. As we discussed previous lecture, first time derivative, second space derivatives, that cannot be covariant. How can we make this covariant? By the way, this triangle here is the Laplacian, and in Minkowski space, this is the sum of the spatial derivatives squared, I mean the second spatial derivatives. So Klein and Gordon looked at the Schrödinger equation and went through the following thought process. They said, this minus h bar squared times the Laplacian is really the momentum squared. It's the position representation of the momentum squared because the momentum operators are minus ih bar d by dxj, the momentum operator in the j direction, in the position representation. In the momentum representation, it's just p. In the Fock representation, it's a minus a, I times a minus a dagger, and so on, right? But in the position representation, that's what it is. And the Schrödinger equation is in the position representation here. So this is really p squared over 2m, or as you may also know it, as 1 half mv squared, the kinetic energy. So this is really just p squared. On the other hand, what is this here? Ih bar d by dt is actually the energy. Why is it the energy? Well, because this is the energy. This is the Hamiltonian, right? So this is the Hamiltonian, and this is equal to it. So this can also be viewed as the energy. So we can write this as E. E is ih bar d by dt. So therefore, in a representation-independent way, we can simply say that this is the energy is equal to p squared divided by 2m, multiplying the psi. So what this means is that E, right, we identify the ih bar d by dt as E, the energy, is equal to p squared divided by 2m. Applied to psi because it's quantum mechanics. But Klein and Gordon said, well, what is that? That's just a non-relativistic relationship between energy and momentum. It says that the energy is equal to 1/2 mv squared. Or the energy is equal to p squared over 2m. That's what it says. If there's no other potential, if there's other energies, well, then they have to be added to the Schrödinger equation. They would be added over here as well. So Klein and Gordon said that the Schrödinger equation simply expresses the non-relativistic relationship between energy and momentum, a so-called dispersion relation. Dispersion relation is always the relationship, the equation, that relates the energy to the wavelength, to the wavelength, which is to the momentum. All right, so they said, well, that is non-relativistic. What would be the relativistic analogon of that? Well, special relativity, well, later we will do it for general relativity, but special relativity says that this is not right, that's right. Namely, that the energy squared divided by c squared minus p vector squared is equal to m squared c squared. You may know this equation also as this equation, p mu contracted is equal to m squared c to the 4. I kept c here. Usually the c is dropped by choosing the unit such that c has the numerical value 1. But it's instructive to keep it in here. Obviously, we need the c squared here so that the units match between those things. So this is what it should be, relativistically speaking. This is what it is for the Schrödinger equation. So then Klein and Gordon said, OK, we know what E is. E is IH body by dt. Pj is minus ih body by dxj. Let's just plug that all in here and then apply that to a wave function. And bang, you get the Klein-Gordon equation. So now you have e squared is minus h bar squared over c squared second time derivative plus h bar squared lambda, nabla. Right. So they arrived at the Klein-Gordon equation here by this consideration. The Klein-Gordon equation is then usually written in the way d by dt squared minus nabla plus m squared psi is equal to 0. By setting c equal to 1, by choosing the units appropriately so that numerically the speed of light is 1. And then these two operators, second time derivative and the sum of the second space derivatives, the Laplacian, the nabla, are put together into one operator, the box operator, the D'Alembertian. So it's D'Alembertian plus n squared, acting on psi is equal to 0. At that point, it seems that we have made a big step here. This doesn't look at all like that. I mean, it doesn't look all that close to that, I mean, this and that. So let's see whether the Klein-Gordon equation reduces in some sense to the Schrödinger equation in the limit.
The energy, that's p squared by 2m. So that's non-relativistic. And the relativistic would be equal to ih by d by d.
So this is the relativistic case.
Right. So they
and that's the non-relativistic.
That's non-relativistic.
Yeah. Right. So then the question is, does this, and if so, how does this reduce to that? So let's just check that. Here's the Klein-Gordon equation. I mean, not applying to the psi, but just the relativistic equation, right? So we can write the Klein-Gordon equation in this way by putting the p squared on the right-hand side. Right? That's the same equation as this one, or same equation as this one. I just put the p squared here on this right-hand side. So that's the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, let's multiply it with c squared. Then we get an m squared c to the fourth plus p vector squared c squared. And then let's take the square root of it so that we get e equal to something. Because here in the Schrödinger equation, we had e equal to something. So here, too, let's take the Klein-Gordon stuff, the so-called mass shell condition or dispersion relation that's relativistic, and put the c squared on the right-hand side and take the square root of it. Of course, we get the plus and a minus sign. It later turns out this is particles and antiparticles. Let's just take the plus sign for now. Obviously, the Klein-Gordon theory is richer than the Schrödinger theory because it has positive and negative solutions here. But let's consider the positive solutions. And then it doesn't look like the Schrödinger equation at all yet. But we can do a Taylor expansion of it. We could say, well, what if the momentum of the particle is so low that we are not in the relativistic regime? In other words, the p vector squared is small compared to c. So we can either say c is large or we can say p vector is small. So let's do an expansion for p vector being small. That's a good approximation because look at this. We have m squared c to the fourth. C to the fourth is guaranteed to be a large number in SI units, for example. OK, so what do we expect then? If we Taylor expand that, then the lowest order term expanding in p vector squared as a variable, the lowest order term is just this, right? And then we get a higher order term. So we choose the positive solution, we get this, and now we Taylor expand that for small p vector squared. And what do we get? We get that the lowest order term for p equal to 0 is just e equal to mc squared, right? We've just rederived e equal mc squared here. And then we get the next order Taylor coefficient, which is what we obtain when we differentiate this, right? So we take the derivative of the square root, that's a 1/2, and then the square root is this expression to the power of plus 1/2, but the derivative is to the power of minus 1/2. And then we take the derivative of the discriminant in here, so we differentiate with respect to the p vector squared, we get a c squared, that's that term. And then we take the p vector squared, that's the variable with respect to which we differentiate it, and then plus higher order terms that go like p to the fourth. All right then, so let's see what these things are. We have equal mc squared, you may have seen that before, and then we have that stuff here. But what is that? Well, what we have here is, let's see, we have to evaluate this at p vector squared equal to 0, because we were Taylor expanding about p vector squared equal to 0. So at that value, if we evaluate that at p vector squared equal to 0, this term goes away. And we have here a c to the fourth square root, that's the c squared, goes away with that c squared. And then we just have a square root of m squared, that's a 1 over m. And we have a 1/2 here. And then we have a p squared. So it's p vector squared over 2m. So that's the kinetic term again. So what we find is that the energy at low energies, at low momenta, is equal to mc squared plus p vector squared over 2m plus higher order terms with p to the fourth. And that's, of course, the 1/2 mv squared kinetic energy term that we usually have plus that extra term. So we have rederived the Schrödinger equation except we got this too. We got a term mc squared as well. Now, does that qualify as having rederived the Schrödinger equation or not? So let's see. We arrive at this for small momenta. So then for small momenta, the Klein-Gordon equation becomes the Schrödinger equation in the sense that we have that e psi is equal to mc squared plus p vector squared over 2m, this thing, times pi. So that's what we get at low energies, at low momenta. And when we represent the p and the e and the space and time representation again through their partial derivative representations, then we obtain this Schrödinger equation, which is almost the usual Schrödinger equation, except we have this pesky extra term mc squared in here. Which means that the Hamiltonian has acquired an extra term, namely this mc squared term. The Hamiltonian for the Schrödinger equation used to be just p squared over 2m, and now we have this extra term mc squared. Of course, we know the origin of it. This is the energy in the rest mass of the particle. Normally, when we consider in quantum mechanics the energy of an electron, then we consider its potential energy, we consider its kinetic energy, but we do not consider its mass energy. But now we see, oh, in principle, there's the mass energy as well, the mc squared, where m is the mass of the electron. However, as we discussed here, again, a constant addition to the Hamiltonian doesn't matter in quantum mechanics. Because if you add to the Hamiltonian here, Hamiltonian plus mc squared times the identity, well, it's times the identity. So the equation of motion of observables is not affected because every observable commutes with the identity. So therefore, we might as well say, sure, we re-derived the Schrödinger equation. The only difference is that the energies are actually different from what we might think they are. The energies are really higher. They are higher by mc squared. And that's an enormous amount of energy, by the way. If you consider, for example, the hydrogen atom, do you remember what the energy levels are of the hydrogen atom? Like the lowest energy level, is it minus 13.6 or something like that, electron volts? Right? So chemistry happens on the scale of electron volts. But what is the mass energy of an electron? That's 500,000 electron volts. It's half a million MeV. It's half MeV. So this is like 500,000 times more than that. But it's constant, so it doesn't really matter. This is not a small thing. It's huge. But since it doesn't show up in the commutator, it doesn't concern us, except in gravitational physics later.
So when we had the energy mentioned before, when we started the Klein-Gordon part, it was p squared by 2m. So technically, that's because the Schrodinger equation doesn't have the mc squared in it.
Yeah.
And we should include the mc squared always when we're talking about Schrodinger equation?
Right. So the true Schrodinger equation should have the mc squared. And we should always say that the electron around the proton in the hydrogen atom has actually an energy of mc squared plus whatever the chemistry says, right? I mean, whatever we calculate there. It just never matters, right? Because you can always just shift that energy around, except gravitationally. As you will see, gravity cares about any kind of energy that there might be. OK, so now remarks. The negative energy solutions spoil the interpretation of psi of x and t as the probability amplitude density. So this business over here that we chose the positive square root instead of the negative square root, you don't really get away with that. In the Klein-Gordon equation, if you wanted to treat it like a Schrödinger equation, you would have to consider the negative solutions too. And Klein-Gordon did, and Dirac did, and it's a whole mess. And then secondly, and this problem is really deep, and it's then resolved not by treating the Klein-Gordon equation like a Schrödinger equation, but by going to second quantization, where we consider the field and its canonically conjugate field, and we apply non-trivial commutation relations between them, then the whole thing changes. See, the issue is this, as we will see today. In the Schrödinger equation, this is the Hamiltonian, right? And that Hamiltonian has all sorts of issues, like this extra term here. And then also, there's a plus and a minus, right? We have, if we derive it from the Klein-Gordon equation, there's a plus and a minus. And for the Klein-Gordon equation, in any case, so the Klein-Gordon equation is this one. This is the Klein-Gordon equation. So what is the Hamiltonian then? If we wanted to do this in first quantization, just like the Schrödinger equation, what would be the Hamiltonian here? In the Schrödinger equation, we know what the Hamiltonian is. It's E, right? So the Schrödinger equation says the energy is this, so that is the Hamiltonian. But the Klein-Gordon equation says the energy squared is this. So what then? Is this the Hamiltonian? No, the Hamiltonian should be the energy, not the energy squared, right? So you would have to take the square root of it. OK, so then the energy of the Hamiltonian would be this. But which one of the two? You have two Hamiltonians now. Right, so you see how you get a problem there. And later we will see that the Klein-Gordon equation simply doesn't have the status of telling us what the Hamiltonian is. Instead, as we will later see, the Klein-Gordon equation is truly just an equation of motion, which is itself derived from a different Hamiltonian. Right? It's a higher level of abstraction, where the Klein-Gordon equation is a solution to something. It's an equation of motion that you derive from a higher order Hamiltonian, a Hamiltonian that you cannot read off from the Klein-Gordon equations. All right, so and also there are the Klein-Gordon method is not the only method to turn the Schrödinger equation into something relativistic. The Dirac equation is another way, then the Maxwell equations are another way, and so on. There are many ways to do this. And in the 1940s, Eugene Wigner figured it all out. And he said, well, what kind of relativistic equations can you possibly have? And he classified the possibilities according to the spin of the particles, the intrinsic angular momentum that these particles have, and according to whether they have a rest mass or they don't. It turns out that the physics is very different of particles that have a rest mass from the physics of particles that don't have a rest mass. Now, for example, photons, you can never slow them down. They're always at the speed of light. Now, neutrinos probably have a mass. But that means you could capture them in a box. You could slow them down. You could slow them down to walking speed, right? Photons, you can't do that. But if the neutrinos had just no mass at all, everything would be very different because they would also always have to travel at the speed of light. So there's a discontinuity there. Physics is discontinuous in that regard. And Wigner worked through that entire jungle. And he showed that for spin zero, there's basically only the Klein-Gordon equation. I'm a little simplifying here because it could be a Klein-Gordon equation for real-valued fields or a Klein-Gordon equation for complex-valued fields. It could be a Klein-Gordon equation for fields that have extra indices that are not space-time indices. But apart from that, it's the Klein-Gordon equation that's always governing spin zero particles. You can reformulate things, but if you reformulate it, it's still equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation. And examples of Klein-Gordon fields are the Higgs field, the inflaton field, and then also the fields of composite particles, such as pi mesons. Pi mesons consist of two quarks. Because they are not consisting only of one elementary particle, but there's a composite, we will call them non-fundamental particles. They are composites. And there are many composite particles that can have spin zero. You can also have atoms and even molecules that have spin zero. But of course, we are mostly interested, for fundamental reasons or in regards to fundamental questions, in the non-composite particles such as neutrinos, electrons, and so on. And then there are spin 1/2 particles, which are described by the Dirac equation. Again, they are also wild spinners, and you know it's a subtler thing, but in essence, it's the Dirac equation that always describes the spin 1/2 particles. And examples are electrons, quarks, but also composite particles such as protons and neutrons are Dirac particles that have spin 1/2. And then for spin 1, there are the Maxwell-Young-Mills equations that describe all of the spin 1 particles, and examples are photons and gluons. Okay, so the Maxwell equations, Maxwell-Young-Mills equations, photons, gluons, and also composite particles. And then there could be particles of higher spin, and they also have their classification of wave equations. However, particles of higher spin, while they do exist as atoms, as molecules, as composite particles, we have not observed any particles of spin higher than 1. We have not observed any elementary, any truly elementary particles of spin larger than 1. And that is nicely consistent with the theoretical observation from quantum field theory, namely that the quantum fluctuations for particles with a spin higher than 1, in principle, cannot be controlled. It seems that they are too divergent to make sense of predictions. So it's only fair that we haven't actually seen such particles. So it has a nice consistency. Quantum field theory cannot handle particles of spin larger than 1, and nature doesn't seem to do particles of spin larger than one, with just one pesky exception, which is that gravity, if it has also particles, would have to be spin two particles. And sure enough, we don't know how to quantize gravity. One reason being that there would be spin two particles and their quantum fluctuations are just getting out of hand. The framework of quantum field theory doesn't seem to be good enough to handle gravity. Nobody quite knows what to do about it. It's a big field of mystery. All right, so we considered harmonic oscillators, we considered relativistic fields. Oh, I should say that just as a word of caution, when Eugene Wigner did this, published this work, he was a kind of postdoc at Princeton. He didn't have the postdoc system, but he didn't have a permanent position. And in Princeton, they thought, what has Wigner done for us lately? And they didn't consider this to be of any significance. So they didn't extend his contract. And then, of course, a few years later, they begged him to come back. And he said, no. Anyway, so now let's look at second quantization.
So in the classification, the parity does not have any influence at all, or even the interactions. For the pions have odd parity. It doesn't make any difference in the classification?
No, not in the classification. It's the basic classification is for mass or not mass and for the spin. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to be said about it. It's not as easy as I might have made it look. It's not just, oh, these are the equations for these particles. There's actually a whole lot of group theory behind this. You have to study the Lorentz group and its possible representations in quantum field theory. If you want to look up the details of this, there is the textbook on quantum field theory by Steven Weinberg, in which he explains these things very nicely. Okay, so second quantization. I gave you some indication of that already in the previous lecture. Let's do a little bit more detail now. So second quantization. In this course, we will only quantize the Klein-Gordon field. This is convenient because it's the easiest field to quantize. But for the purpose of cosmology, it's perfectly fine because, as it turns out, so far, the only case of fields that are of cosmological significance are the Klein-Gordon fields. And there's a particular reason for that, which is the way in which scalar fields contribute to the energy. And scalar fields contribute to the energy in a particular way, and only scalar fields can do that. This is not to say that there cannot be surprises, but so far it seems that scalar fields are the most important ones for cosmology. Okay, so for the purpose of second quantization, we will now change terminology. So far, we've talked about the Schrödinger equation with its wave function psi, and the state was called psi. But now we will no longer talk about wave functions. We will no longer talk about the wave equations here per se, but we will speak of the fields as fields, no longer as wave functions. And there is a good reason for changing the terminology and the notation. And the reason is that in first quantization, the psi of x is the probability density, the probability amplitude density for finding the particle at x. In second quantization, the phi of x is no such thing. It's of course not the probability density for finding a particle somewhere, because for one, it has a hat on it. It's an operator. It's not complex number value. So it's far from being a wave function or anything like that. So we will switch notation, and we will no longer use the psi. We will use the notation phi for these fields now. And we say goodbye to the idea that they might represent probability densities. They don't. And so we will call them fields. The letter psi will make a resurgence, but in a different way. You see, once we do the quantum theory of fields, then the field as a whole will have a Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian will act on state vectors. And those state vectors we will call kets, and they will be the ket psi, for example. But they have nothing to do with the first quantization stuff. It's just the states of a quantum field now. And remember that the quantum field can describe not just one particle, but any number of particles, right? And so the Hamiltonian and the state, the entire framework of a quantum field theory, describes all particles at once, not them individually, even cases in which the particle number is not well defined. There's going to be a number operator whose eigenvalues are the integers, the positive integers. But you can have states in which the number of particles is not even well defined, where you have an expectation value of 3.7 particles or something like this. Not for all species. For electrons, you can't have it. But for photons, you can have it, for example. OK, so we will switch notation now. We will speak of psi's. And psi, the letter psi is specifically reserved for states later on. And we will no longer speak of the wave functions, but of fields. So we define now the canonically conjugate field to phi. So phi of x and t is our field whose quantum theory we want to consider. And at this point, I'd like to remind you of this picture with the pond or the lake and the waves on it and so on. And you can think of the phi as being the amplitude, the elevation of the water at the location x at the time t. Now, if we hold x fixed, it's like putting a cork somewhere at the location x in the lake. And then what we have is that phi of t is a function of time, right? It's the cork's elevation. Phi is the elevation of the cork as a function of time. We hold x fixed. The cork is fixed in place there, but it can go up and down. And then what we have is that phi at the fixed x, phi is a harmonic oscillator. As we will see, phi is a harmonic oscillator. And then the phi at a different x is another harmonic oscillator, and so on. And these harmonic oscillators will be coupled to each other. Very important here is to realize that the x here is no longer a position operator. In quantum field theory, it's a parameter, just like t. And this x is labeling where the harmonic oscillator is. So we have now no position operators anymore. In quantum field theory, there are no position operators. I can tell you why there cannot possibly be position operators in quantum field theory. That came out in work with my PhD student, Maria Papageorgiou. You can look up her thesis. She has a little section on this. Imagine if there was a position operator in quantum field theory. What would it mean? It would mean you calculate this expectation value, you find the expectation for where you find the particle. That cannot make sense. And the reason is that where you find a particle with what probability fundamentally depends on how you look for it. For example, take an electron. You can look for an electron by using the fact that it has electric charge. So you take another charge and you try to use it to detect where the electron is. You take a charge to sniff out another charge. But you could also look for the electron using the fact that it has mass. So you take a test mass, and with this test mass, you can check, you know, whether there's gravitationally something pulling at it, and you can find an electron through its gravitational interaction. But the electron also has a weak interaction charge. So you can take a weakly charged particle, such as a neutrino, and then with it, you can sniff out where the electron is. But there's no reason that the probability distribution for where the electron is the same independently of which method you use to look for it. Right? So if anything, there ought to be different position operators for different ways for looking for a particle. And in any case, there are other reasons of relativity and so on, but there cannot be position operators in quantum field theory.
Also, like, it does, wouldn't it not make sense because phi or pi is not really a probability distribution or probability amplitude.
Yeah, yeah, they're not. That's right.
So it doesn't make sense. So
yeah, yeah, yeah. In any case, that's right. The phi is not a probability density at all, of probability amplitude density at all. Yeah.
Just to maybe push back a little bit, but can't you be pedantic and, I don't know, maybe impose like an equivalence principle and say, just like the gravitational mass is equivalent, you can say that the position...
That all means of looking for it should be equivalent?
I'm just saying.
Well, then take, for example, the strong interaction. The electron doesn't care about the strong interaction. With the strong interaction, you can't find it at all. Right? So they can't be all equivalent because some interactions would be useless, actually. All right, so no position operators in quantum field theory. X is a parameter now. I will later show you how the first quantized theory is still contained in the second quantized theory. But it's not as simple as just saying that this is an X, that this is a position operator per se. All right, so the X is now downgraded again to just being a parameter. I mean, the X1, X2, X3 are just coordinates. And here we have the time variable as well. So what we have is that at every point in space, we have a harmonic oscillator whose amplitude is phi. And that's the thing that can oscillate and that we will quantize. So we have one harmonic oscillator at every point in space. And the X is just labeling which harmonic oscillator we are talking about. And each one of these harmonic oscillators has not only an amplitude, like Q, the single harmonic oscillator that we considered earlier, but it also has a canonically conjugate variable. And the canonically conjugate variable for the simple harmonic oscillator is just Q dot. P is equal to Q dot. And now we say the canonically conjugate variable to phi is pi dot. Pi is phi dot. Right? The canonically conjugate is phi dot. So the degree of freedom that we are considering here is the amplitude of the quark as it goes up and down. And its canonically conjugate variable is the speed with which it goes up and down. It's the momentum with which it goes up and down. So at every point in space, at every point x, we have an amplitude, which says how far up or down it is, and the speed with which it goes up or down, the pi. This is the canonically conjugate pair. Now, that's for a scalar field. For a vector field such as the electric field, not so easy, right? Because there we have the electric field three components, and then it has its canonically conjugate momentum as well. And for the electromagnetic field, you have that the they have the E and the B field, and they are not quite as trivially related. But for the Klein-Gordon field that we are working with here, yes, the pi is just the phi dot. Before we switch on gravity, then things become more complicated. All right, so we define the pi as phi dot. That's completely analogous to previously when we said the pi is qi dot. So now we can rewrite the Klein-Gordon equation. The Klein-Gordon equation used to be phi double dot minus the Laplacian phi plus m squared is zero. But the phi double dot is pi single dot. OK, so we can write the Klein-Gordon equation in this way now. Just because the phi dot has its own name, which is the pi. That's, of course, important because those two guys will not commute with each other. Now, there's an important thing to mention briefly before we move on. The Klein-Gordon equation, this equation here, does not couple the real part and the imaginary part of phi to each other. So if you have a real valued solution and you have an imaginary valued solution, the sum of the two is also a solution, right? Because it doesn't care, because there's no I in there. Unlike the Schrödinger equation, which has an I, this one doesn't. So this one doesn't care, and you can have real valued solutions only, or imaginary solutions. And what that means is that in what follows, we can restrict attention to the case of real valued phi. We wouldn't be able to do that in the Schrödinger equation. But here we can do that. And what that means is that we can describe Klein-Gordon particles that are neutral. They are electromagnetically neutral. If you want to make them charged, you would have to consider complex valued phis. But that's not an extra complication, really, because the two components are just independent of another. It only matters that it's complex valued when you couple it to the electromagnetic field and to the charges. All right, so we will generally assume the phi to be real valued, realizing that that's not really a restriction on the generality. We can easily upgrade that to complex valued and therefore charged particles. So now we are ready for quantization. We have phi fields and we have pi fields. So we impose canonical commutation relations now. Remember, we keep the equations of motion the same, so the Klein-Gordon equation will still be in place. And in addition, we have this relationship between pi and phi, so pi is phi dot. And now the canonical commutation relations. So what we have here is the amplitude at the location x doesn't commute with the amplitude at doesn't commute with the pi field at x prime if x is equal to x prime. Otherwise, they're independent. So what this is saying is that we have a degree of freedom for every x where phi and pi are canonically conjugate to each other. If x is equal to x prime, then this is not zero. So they don't commute. And so for every location, wherever you are, for every x, the phi doesn't commute with its pi. It has this IH bar commutation relation. But whenever you consider the phi of one location and the pi of another location, they commute with each other. And of course, the phis commute always and the pis commute always. This is completely analogous to what we had in usual quantum mechanics, where we have that if we have various different degrees of freedom, then the q and the p are only non-commutative for the same degree of freedom and commuting for otherwise. So we have to impose now these commutation relations, and we keep this equation of motion, and we keep that equation of motion. Later, of course, a large part of the course will be to figure out how they change in general relativity. And then, once we have that, how to calculate the Hilbert space representations, find the vacuum energy, and stuff like that. So we have the canonical commutation relations, we have the equations of motion, and we impose that the field is real, real valued in the classical theory. And in the quantum theory, it means that the phi is a Hermitian or self-adjoint field, where for every phi hat of x, its Hermitian conjugate is itself. So we have the canonical commutation relations. We have the equations of motion. What about a Hamiltonian? Is there a Hamiltonian such that the Heisenberg equation of motion, this one, gives us the Klein-Gordon equation? And the answer is yes. You see, here we have the canonical commutation relations. Here we have the equations of motion. And we can ask, is there a Hamiltonian, a second quantized Hamiltonian, an energy functional, an energy expression, such that the time derivative of phi, so f hat dot is time derivative of phi, is equal to pi, is that equation, right? And if we, so if we plug the phi in here for f, with this to be found Hamiltonian, we want this equation to boil down to be this. If we choose for f hat the pi, then we want that equation to turn out to be the Klein-Gordon equation. And here's the Hamiltonian that does it. So this Hamiltonian is 1 half, it's the integral over space. It's 1 half the canonically conjugate momentum field squared plus phi, and then m squared minus Laplacian phi, and the whole thing integrated up. This is completely analogous to having a bunch of harmonic oscillators, really. Because look at what happens if you have in ordinary quantum mechanics a bunch of harmonic oscillators. Well, let's say you label the harmonic oscillators with an index a. Then you get a kinetic term Somebody doesn't agree. So you get a kinetic term, right? And you get a potential term. So for each A, you get a harmonic oscillator. And here it's the same thing, except that we're not summing, we're integrating, because we have a harmonic oscillator at every point, right? And here we have the momentum squared, just like here, momentum squared half. And then here we have the omega squared half q hat squared. Now, we have here we have q hat squared, and here we have phi hat squared, and here we have omega squared, and here we have m squared minus Laplacian. And you might think, no, that's very different, right? Because here we have a derivative. We have a derivative here, and we have this m squared. That doesn't look like it's just an omega squared. But it turns out if you Fourier transform it, it becomes exactly that. Anyway, so this is a sum of harmonic oscillators. And I can now also show you exactly how it is the sum of harmonic oscillators that are coupled to each other. Namely, imagine you drop that term. So we get rid of the Laplacian here. So no space derivatives. Then what do we have? Then we have, for every x, right, we're integrating over all these three x. So we integrate over all locations. And for each location, we have the kinetic term, p squared half, and we have phi squared m squared, which is exactly this, right, where we have omega squared and then the amplitude squared. And in this case, the omega squared is m squared. So what we see is that we have at every point in space a harmonic oscillator. That's the kinetic term, and this is literally just this term here, where the natural frequency omega squared is m squared. However, we also have that. So if we didn't have it, we would simply have one independent harmonic oscillator at every location, and that's it. If that was all there is in nature, then it would be like having a lake. That's very weird, because if you throw a stone in one place, then only there it would oscillate, but the waves would not spread, right? So the harmonic oscillators need to be coupled in order to have waves spread. That's what this term does. This term has derivatives of the phi, and that means that these terms know of what the neighbor does. Right? This is an additional term. This is just independent harmonic oscillators, and these are coupling terms between these harmonic oscillators. And of course, they are going to be super crucial in quantum field theory on curved space-time with gravity, because gravity, when it's curved, will affect the neighborhood relationships, which means the Laplacian is not just going to be the sum of the second derivatives. It's going to have the metric and the affine connection in it. We'll have the curvature in it. And that means that the coupling between these harmonic oscillators will be affected. OK, so if we take this Hamiltonian, if we take this Hamiltonian, the claim is from it, we can rederive, this Hamiltonian plus these commutation relations plus this statement of quantum theory in general for all quantum theories, first quantization, second quantization, one millionth quantization, it's always IH bar f hat dot equal to commutator f hat with h hat, right? So this is true for all quantum theories, not just quantum mechanics, but also quantum field theory. So if we take this, the so-called Heisenberg equation, with this Hamiltonian and these commutation relations, then these two equations of motion follow. Right? So we should really view this Hamiltonian as being primary and these equations as being derived. Yeah, you had a question?
Boundary conditions?
You mean inertial conditions?
No, boundary. Is this free space quantization?
This free space, yeah. Oh, yeah. If you have, let's say, in the Casimir effect, we will talk about that later on, then you can have non-trivial effects also because of boundaries. Right, so let's check this. So the claim is this Hamiltonian plugged into here, and then you use for the F, you use phi, you should get this equation of motion. If for the F hat, you use pi, then you should get the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's do one, and then you can do the other one at home. So For example, we have here the Heisenberg equation, where we choose for our h this Hamiltonian up there, and for the f we choose the phi hat. Phi hat. So up here, this is the Hamiltonian. Look at it up here on the right. And then here's the Hamiltonian. We plug it in here. That's the h. And then we take the phi hat of x and t as our f. And then we have on the left-hand side ih bar phi hat dot. OK, so that's the Klein. This is the Heisenberg equation of motion for the observable phi hat of x and the Hamiltonian given up here. And then explicitly, it's this expression where we notice that the Hamiltonian has the canonically conjugate to phi, namely pi, up here. And then all of these terms are just phis, and they're space derivatives. But the phi commute with the phi. So I can write here simply something of phi dependence, because I know it's going to drop out by the next line. So what do we have? We have, therefore, it's the commutator of phi with this plus the commutator of phi with that, which is 0. Now, here we have the commutator of phi with pi squared. And for this, we can use that if you have a b, c commutator, this is b, a, c plus commutator a, b with c. And so we use that, where b and c are the same. They're just phi. And we get this commutator times pi plus pi times that commutator. Both of those commutators are just Dirac deltas times ih bar from the canonical commutation relations up there. There. This one. So we put this now down here. And we get here Dirac delta times pi plus pi times Dirac delta. The Dirac deltas eat up the integral, and we just obtain that, that it's pi, pi hat of x and t times ih bar. This ih bar cancels that ih bar, and what we obtain is that phi hat dot is pi. Right? Now, I leave it to you to carry out the same sort of calculation, slightly non-trivial, because we have the space derivative in there, where you use in here the pi. And then, after a little bit of gymnastics, you get the Klein-Gordon equation out of this. So you see, the whole thing is happening now at a higher level, because the Klein-Gordon equation is no longer the starting point. It's being arrived at by this Hamiltonian. From this Hamiltonian, you can derive the Klein-Gordon equation. What's also important here is, and I think I mentioned it briefly in the previous lecture, is that this is not a Kronecker delta. It's a Dirac delta. With a Kronecker delta, we would have that this is either 1 or 0 here. And then we get the usual uncertainty principle whenever this is not 0. But now this is blowing up to infinity at x equal to x prime. The way to deal with this is, if you want to derive an uncertainty principle, is to say, I'm not actually looking at this observable itself. I'm not looking at, at phi hat of x and t. Because it, on one hand, it has this infinite commutator with pi. On the other hand, I can't really measure any of that, because I would need an infinite accuracy in location to measure this. So what you do is you multiply that with the window function of x hat d3x. And then you call that, I don't know, let's say a hat. Okay, so this is saying, let's say I cannot measure the amplitude. This could be the electric field or something, right? It's a scalar one, but it would be similar for the electric field. I cannot measure what the amplitude is down to a dot, to an actual point, right? But I can measure its average over some volume, tiny volume, but still a finite volume. That's what I do here. This W describes some sort of volume, right? So it's a function that is 0, and then where I am actually performing the measurement, it goes up to 1, and then it goes down to 0 again, something like that, right? And then you define a similar thing, integral pi hat of x and t, with another window function, or it could be the same window function, and then d3x. And then from that, you can calculate what the commutator is. Let's call this one b hat. And then you can calculate the commutator between a hat and b hat. And because of these so-called smearing functions, this Dirac delta will actually behave itself. And you get some finite stuff here on the right. You get I h bar finite. Right? If the omega is just a Dirac delta, then you're back to the usual problem. But otherwise, it gets smeared out. It's finite. And then from that, you get a delta a, delta b, larger equal to something finite. Now, the thing is that the smaller, the more spiky you make the w, the closer you get to a Dirac delta, and therefore the larger this finite thing is, and therefore the larger these uncertainties are, which means that quantum fields fluctuate the more, the smaller the resolution is with which you look at them. And if you remember Wigner's classification, what Wigner showed is that, Wigner didn't show, but later it was found that those fields that have a spin larger than one have that this behavior is bad when the spin is larger than one, the behavior is bad when you make the omega more and more spiky. So it behaves badly in the sense that you can't really make sense of it anymore. A fundamental problem because gravity is spin too. So we would really need to figure that one out. Now, later in the course, we will do this in all detail. We will go through these things because these quantum fluctuations of fields, according to the current standard model of cosmology, are responsible for the inhomogeneities in the universe today. So we will have to do these calculations anyway. But at the same time, you can always keep in the back of your mind, well, what if I actually wanted to quantize gravity? Is there some way that we can do this for spin 2 and other particles as well? OK, so this is as far as we got today. I would recommend that you derive the Klein-Gordon equation from this Hamiltonian just to get more familiarity with what the structure is of this thing. Look at it again and say, aha. This is just a harmonic oscillator for every point, and you sum up the energies of all these oscillators, you sum up the Hamiltonians of each of these harmonic oscillators, and then these space derivatives couple these harmonic oscillators to another. Another thing that you can see here is that if you Fourier transform the whole thing, the derivatives become multiplications. And then you get uncoupled harmonic oscillators. That's going to play a big role later in the course. That in principle, yes, we have coupled harmonic oscillators for our fields. That's why when you throw a stone into the pond, the waves spread. That's why when you shake an electron here, electromagnetic waves in this case, will spread everywhere. So you may wonder, but if I Fourier transform, I decouple that. So I have independent harmonic oscillators. What about the spread? The answer is that if you Fourier transform this, well then, you're no longer looking at it in position space, but in momentum space. And now imagine you excite a harmonic oscillator in momentum space. What does that mean? It means, for example, you create light of a particular momentum, of a particular frequency, of a particular direction and color. It's not going to change that on its own. You see, if you have a red laser beam, then it's always going to be that red laser beam forever. If it just travels through the universe, it's always that red laser beam with the same momentum. It's not going to make nearby laser beams that are blue and green or something. No. You see, in momentum space, whatever you excite stays that way. It doesn't spread. In momentum space, waves do not spread. They only spread in position space. In momentum space, a color stays a color, except gravity, right? Because gravity can make stuff change its color. If you have blue light emanating from a galaxy far away, Well, if that galaxy is traveling far away from us, if the space is expanding, you get redshift, right? So that's when the harmonic oscillators start to couple, even in momentum space. I'm just anticipating stuff here. We will do this systematically, and all of that will come up slowly, one after the other. Okay, that's as far as we got today. Navneet?
So in this, the lake example, the coupling is because of the cohesion or the electrostatic interaction between the...
In the case of the lake.
In the case of the lake.
Yeah, it's the water molecules. Yeah.
So my point is that we are presuming, we are starting off in this formalism that there is an interaction between the oscillators.
Yeah.
Because it might be for any particle, the field might be for any particle. But we are presuming for every particle, the oscillator does have a coupling. What is the ontological basis for that? I mean, like in the case of the lake, we know there is this force. So,
yes.
So we are presuming, in the, this is a fundamental formalism, and we are putting in something.
Yes.
The interaction, we are already putting it in.
Right. It's true that for the lake, we can go deeper. We could say, okay, here's the equation of motion for the water waves. But we can derive it from something deeper. We can say, well, the lake is made out of water molecules, and those water molecules have such and such properties. And because of those properties, the speed of sound in water is this, the viscosity is that, etc., etc. And then we can calculate what the wave equation is. Here, we don't have that. It's generally assumed that this is the basic level. That, for example, for electromagnetism, we cannot really track where it's coming from. I think maybe we can derive it somehow. There are attempts at explaining where the fields come from, why the fields are what they are. But so far, not really successfully. I would say the state of the art is that we have the standard model of particle physics and standard model of cosmology, described by a certain Hamiltonian that has contributions from all kinds of fields. And we see some systematics in there, some symmetries. We can classify electromagnetism, the weak and the strong interaction, through their symmetry groups. We see some symmetries emerging there, and a lot of work has been done on trying to unify that, but not successfully. I think that's a big unsolved problem, why the standard model looks the way it does. Yeah, there are plenty of attempts, but I would say none of them successful so far. I mean, string theory would say that, yeah, there's a lower level, a deeper level of understanding, which is that particles are, the particle species are just excitations of little strings. But string theory is in trouble, right? There's no supersymmetry as far as we can tell, and apparently it doesn't work without supersymmetry. We have a lack of models of that. I mean, some would say the answer is that, as we discussed last time, you know, universes could be spawning universes, and then by the entropic principle, we find ourselves, of course, in a livable universe, and for that we need a certain composition of the Hamiltonians. But that would be very unsatisfactory. It would be much, much better. I think it's too early to give up. Because the entropic principle is basically giving up. We are no longer trying to explain things.
And second question, just related to this. So, of course, we need to do it because we need to explain the world. We need to have this coupling so that interaction, all those things happen. But apart from that, is it the ease of maths, the canonical commutation relations that we need? Because I think historically, in the black body radiation, Planck used this more decomposition.
Yeah.
For using the
canonical. Yes, that's right.
Quantization method.
Yes.
So here again, even if we couple that, would it just make the math difficult? That's why we go to
the math.
The quantization difficult, because we go to the momentum.
Yes. No, we will later do that. We will do the quantization. We will do most of calculations in the momentum representation.
If we don't do that, would it just make the math difficult, that's all, or it would have some implication otherwise as well?
No, it can be done also in the position representation. Some people have made a point of never using the momentum space. You can do that, yeah. But it's an important point that you raised about what Planck did. You see, Planck was at that point, basically, that we discussed today, 100 years ago, or 120 years ago. And he said, okay, the field, like the electromagnetic field, can be decomposed into harmonic oscillators. And then he said, well, but what about these harmonic oscillators? The trouble seemed to be that every harmonic oscillator, when exposed to a heat bath, is withdrawing, on average, an energy of kT. Right? If K is the Boltzmann constant and T is the temperature of the heat bath. So in particular, the electromagnetic field, consisting of infinitely many harmonic oscillators for all frequencies, right, would each harmonic oscillator would be greedily grabbing a kT of energy from any heat bath. But that, of course, means that the electromagnetic field would suck up an infinite amount of heat. And Planck knew that that's nonsense. That's not going to happen. So what he thought is that maybe harmonic oscillators cannot do that. And so he thought, well, what could it be about harmonic oscillators that prevents them from doing this? And what it could be is that the energy levels of the harmonic oscillator are discrete. Because if the energy levels are discrete, then what happens if you have such a harmonic oscillator and you have the ground state, and then let's say the first excited state is high up, but the temperature is low. In this case, how is the harmonic oscillator supposed to get a kT? See, it's either in the ground state, or it's in the first excited state, or even higher. But if the temperature energy scale is like here, just above the ground state, well then what? The harmonic oscillator cannot be in the excited state. It cannot get a kT. So in other words, it stays in the ground state. It's very unlikely to be in the first excited state. So the energy expectation value is way below kT. Which means that the harmonic oscillators freeze out and they do not participate in what is called equipartition in thermodynamics. So Planck thought, well, if harmonic oscillators have a discrete spectrum, or more exact, or more precisely, if they have a gap over the ground state, then, well, those harmonic oscillators that have too large a gap compared to the temperature don't participate. They don't withdraw a kT. And so he just ad hoc assumed that the harmonic oscillators have this discrete spectrum and then found that the energy expectation value for each mode is just what's needed to get the blackbody spectrum. But he had no reason to assume that the harmonic oscillator spectrum is discrete. Right? And then Einstein looked at this and said, Planck, good job. You described blackbody radiation correctly. And then Einstein said, well, that probably means that there are photons. and these photons have energy h bar omega, right? And that was what made Einstein famous at the time.
So does that mean that we don't know yet underlying what's the reason for the interactions in the quantum field?
Why the fields interact with each other?
Right.
No, we don't know. I mean, the standard model could look different. Instead of having the electromagnetic weak and strong force and gravity, we could have 27 different kinds of forces and 5 fundamental particles instead of like 27 or whatever we have now. It wouldn't contradict anything. We have some constraints that nature does seem to obey. For example, remember I mentioned last time that symmetries of a classical theory can be broken by the quantum theory. Quantum fluctuations can break symmetries. In other words, the symmetry may only be present for the classical solutions, but the fluctuations don't obey them. And if that happens, then the quantization, the ability to write down a quantum theory, might be destroyed. And so these so-called anomalies represent a big problem for quantum theories. And it seems that nature abhors those anomalies. It usually avoids them. And so that gives us some handle on what the standard model has to look like. Just like theoretical considerations tell us that particles of spin larger than 1, we can't really write down quantum theories for. And nature doesn't do them either, except gravity. Yeah.
One last thing. So here in the accommodation relations, equal time accommodation relation, we are already putting in locality very strongly over there from the very beginning.
Yes, we do. yes, it's true, and probably we shouldn't. And I wrote papers on this, and my students wrote papers on this, and yes, there are ways of not assuming this. Allowing for the possibility that the very notion of space-time distance breaks down at short distances.
This is one way of quantizing a theory. I was always wondering about Lagrangians. So you can do Lagrangian field theory and derive the equations of motion. Why not do that and put hats? And I know that you can, if you do that, sometimes what you think is the conjugate field or the momenta is not the same through both processes, especially if there's coupling.
We will do this very carefully. We will do both Hamiltonians and Lagrangians in order to find out what the canonically conjugate fields are. And there are ambiguities about what is the Hamiltonian. You know, there will be a can of worms that we will have to very carefully navigate there. At first, when you talked about Lagrangians, I thought you were going in the direction of path integrals. You see, because that's based on Lagrangians. And that's the very last lecture where we do that. Okay? Great.
So, you know how you mentioned that you could complexify phi? So, for the Hamiltonian, for the second quantization, would that just change? Instead of R3, you also integrate over
there? What happens is that you get here a psi dagger psi, a pi dagger pi. Okay. You get a phi dagger phi. And you get that this factor 1/2 goes away.
And you still integrate over R3?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, you do.
And also, for the metric, will we be using the signature where it's minus plus plus plus?
Yeah. Otherwise, I will mention it. I mean, sometimes I might have worked with different sources, and so they might not be entirely consistent, but usually I use that, that signature.